welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is the first ever on the road all ball, right? Literally on an interstate between Asheville, North Carolina, and Harrisburg, Virginia. And what you're going to hear over the next hour or so is a podcast with Ryan Odom. Now, Ryan and I know each other a little bit. My brother and Ryan are good friends, but if you're listening to this and you're a fan and you're like, boy, they really seem like they know each other. Like, it's called in Hebrew, it's mishpucha, which is like family. My family by choice. In basketball, it totally makes sense if you're a hoop guy, right? His dad was a coach, high school coach, became a college assistant, became big time college head coach. And my dad was a high school coach, became a college assistant, became a college head coach, a college assistant, then an AAU coach, whatever. It's basketball family. And there's some interesting ties that bind there. And ultimately, obviously, what we led up to is the greatest upset in the history of college basketball. And you're going to be, I think, fascinated by it. But it's his own personal journey. And remarkably, like, I set this up through my brother, Greg, who does deserve producing credit. And, you know, I wanted to do it right now as we get into championship week, into the NCAA tournament. And it's just timely and perfect and enjoyable. And Virginia is still the defending national champion as of now. But when we set it up, he was the one seed. And I was like, all right, well, you know, they're going to win their tournament and then we'll get him. And it's like, so they were upset by the 8 seed. And then it became even more timely, more perfect. And I thought to myself, you're not going to want to do it. You know, it's just too emotional. It's too hard. You know, these coaches, they lose a game. They bury themselves in a bunker for a month and good luck getting them out of it. And I texted Ryan day after they lost, maybe 2 days, like, hey man, if you don't want it, he's like, no, we're doing it. How about we do it Monday? And then Monday didn't work, and now Tuesday. So this is dropping on a Wednesday of championship week, and I know you will enjoy it. It's impossible not to, because he's just a delightful human being. I do have to promote the fact that, one, there are a litany of other all-ball podcasts that are amazing. From Tremaine Davis, who was awarded the state at 3 and just recently was the ceremonial captain at the Super Bowl. There's a two-parter with Jay Billis. You can dig through and find, just, you know, where you searched out this podcast. There's Scott Brooks podcast. There's Nate Oates podcast. There's so many good ones. And it's interesting. I kind of started doing this as a bit of a passion project. I just like catching up with friends or people that I'm fascinated by in the sport that I love. There's also a TJ Hushmanzano one about his life and background, which is not really basketball, but his personal story is so good and so interesting, you know, selling drugs in Oklahoma City as a teenager into making it to the NFL and becoming a Pro Bowler. Kind of cool. We got them all in here. Just download the catalog. Also, you can listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show daily, 3-6 Eastern, 12-3 Pacific. But this thing is growing leaps and bounds, and guys like Ryan are the reason why. They have time. They tell their story. They share it with you. Dan Munson's podcast. Dan, of course, son of Don, another coach's son, was the head coach at Gonzaga when they made that initial Elite Eight run. That was like a month ago. You can download that. That's a two-parter, and every bit of it is good. And the honesty in it is amazing. Amazing. You know, sometimes you get a guy and like, I know there's more to the story. And most of the guys that we've had, they've just talked and told their story. It's an organic conversation. We try and do that on the radio. Obviously, there's some more time constraints, and there's some other parts to it. I should also point out the Andrew Bogut two-parter. There's some language issues sometimes, not that he doesn't speak English, in terms of our cursing a little bit more rife, a little bit more real than some of the others. So download those. They're great. Listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show, 3-6 Eastern, Fox Sports Radio, iHeartRadio app. I've lived this basketball journey now for, I think 83 was the first time I remember, right? And we talked about that in the pod. I remember Final Fours. I've gone to Final Fours. I didn't play in a Final Four. I wish I did. You know, people always like, you play with Big Country. Like, nah, that was not me. No, you play with Tony Allen. No, that was John Lucas. That wasn't me. We lost in Elite Eight. So maybe I'll do a pod next week on the NCAA tournament, my memories of playing in it. I think I've done some of that. But the 16-1. You know, it had never happened before. And statistics will tell you that ultimately it was going to happen. But logic, to me, said might not ever happen because low major is like a bad word that's used traditionally in recruiting and in coaching, and then low major, because somehow it just feels different than mid-major. But the low majors, the true one-bid leagues, those are being rated by the mid and high majors. You recruit a kid, you think he's a little bit better, a mid-major minus, or maybe even a mid-major, mid-major plus, and you get him and he's so good that everybody takes notice. And so an AAU coach or an assistant coach in college somehow finds a way to the family, to the connector, and they transfer up, right? I mean, Cleveland State's program was rated. San Jose State has been rated. You go across the country, and there's lots of these kids. Like, I mean, look at Division III programs that are losing players to the Division I programs. So I thought recently that because guys are transferring up from the lower levels, I wasn't sure what happened. Now, it's important to point out that Virginia did have a major injury to DeAndre Hunter, and that changed them not just in terms of their go-to guy, but also he allowed them to play smaller and more four out, one in. But that didn't, if you go back and watch that game, it didn't feel that much like an upset. It just didn't. And it was because it was an ass kick by UMBC. Got out of hand at the end. Anyway, Ryan Odom is son of the great coach and kind of legendary coach, right, in college basketball. His personal story has been told many times over, and he's come out the other side. He had a great year. They won the league this year at UMBC, but obviously fell short in the conference tournament. If you're known for one thing and known for pulling off arguably the greatest upset in the history of college basketball, that ain't a bad thing. There's a lot more to him. I think you'll enjoy this conversation. Here's the head coach of Maryland Baltimore County, Ryan Odom. College basketball is crazy, right? Obviously. And I want to get to what happened most recently and then what you're probably most known for. But I want to start, like, when you were born, we're both sons of coaches. But I think it was right in the window of your dad going from being a high school coach to a college assistant. Is that accurate?
Exactly. Yeah. I was born in 74, and my father was the head coach at Durham High School. And, back then, John Lucas was playing at a rival high school. There was all kinds of good players around there. A guy named Marshall Ashford played for him. Who ended up going on to Virginia Tech to be a really good guard. But, he started in Goldsboro. That's where he was born and raised. And so his father was a car dealer. And so
his dad was a car dealer?
His dad was a car dealer. Yeah, in the car dealership in Goldsboro, maybe the Cadillac. I have no idea what it was, but he would work there every summer. And so the thought was, hey, he's going to take it over one day. That's just going to be what happens. And so he went and played basketball for a guy named Jerry Steele at Guilford. He'll kill me for saying High Point. He at Guilford College. And, Jerry Steele was a great player at Wake Forest, one of the best big guys in the 60s, back when they went to the Final Four and played with Billy Packer and that crew. And they were very close in age. So Jerry had just graduated from Wake. Dad was just coming into Guilford. And so that was kind of his first connection into the basketball world was through Jerry Steele. Jerry played for Bugs McKinney. And, you know, he mentored Dad. Dad played football as well. He played basketball. He played baseball all at Guilford, you know, in college, and just loved sports. So he ends up, after graduating from college, going home to Goldsboro and coaches at his high school that he graduated from, Goldsboro High School. There a couple of years. My brother Lane, who you know, is born there at the time in Goldsboro. And then he moves on, gets offered the Durham High job. That's where I'm born in 74. And so he was very fortunate in that he got to know, at that point, Vic Bubas was the head coach at Duke. Chuck Daly was an assistant. Hubie Brown was an assistant. I mean, it was a who's who on that staff, you know, at that point. And so he would go over there, you know, almost daily to watch the practices and do all that. And so his connection and initial entree into college basketball was through, they introduced him to Garf. And so he was kind of the first Southern guy to go up to five-star basketball camp. And, you know, he literally would drive the bus up, and all the local players in North Carolina would go up there with him and, you know, spend a week or two and go to the camp. And so he became obviously really close with, you know, all the coaching characters of that time, the Tinos and, you know, obviously Garf and Fratella. And he met all those guys and has remained close with them for years. But I wouldn't be coaching if it wasn't for him coaching at Durham High and, you know, them connecting him to Garf.
It's amazing. My dad, so my grandpa was an accountant.
Yeah.
In New York. And he's a very successful accountant. And he became a car dealer because he would take over parts of people's businesses because, you know, you look at the books, you're like, this is in bad shape because they don't know what they don't know what they're doing. And, you know, with his accounting background, he took over a car dealership on Long Island. My dad was like 13 and moved out to Long Island. And he became the most successful car dealer on Long Island because he was the first to start leasing. And he was leasing to soldiers who were coming back from, you know, any sort of battle, whatever. He had connections within like the VA, and they would, you know, get off a boat and you have a brand new Cadillac for them.
Yeah.
Anyway, it kind of similarly, like, so my dad, his first job was at Fairlawn High School in New Jersey. And I believe the previous coach was Hubie Brown.
No way.
And yeah. And then my dad, he had this mercurial journey where he was like, he was the head coach at, Colorado Springs High School, at Death Valley High School, at I'll think of it in a second, somewhere out in Western Pennsylvania, close to where Jerry Lucas grew up.
Yeah. And
anyway, it's interesting kind of the similarity. So
yeah.
Your dad goes to Wake as an assistant and you're like 2 years old.
Yeah. Right?
So your earliest memories of basketball were more in a college gym or in a high school gym? Like, what are your earliest memories?
Definitely college.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely college. I mean, I remember Wake a little bit. They had, because my brother was, you know, my brother's 6-7 years older than me or whatever. And so at halftime, they always had this thing called the Dribbling Deacons. And so Lane was a part of the Dribbling Deacons. So I sort of remember that. And then, you know, he left there, you know, and became the head coach at East Carolina. And so we moved down to Greenville, and I definitely remember that being there. I remember summer camps, you know, going to his camp, and he would always have great college counselors. I can remember James Worthy came, you know, one, it was probably his, after his junior or sophomore year or something. It was when he broke his leg and he was out for basically the summer.
Wait, he broke his leg at the camp?
No. I think it was, okay. He had some sort of surgery over the summer. And so I just remember him being at the camp with this huge cast on. I don't know how you work camp with a cast on, but he did it. And then, you know, dad left there after 3 years and you know, went up to Virginia. And that was kind of an odd thing, you know, because he was a head coach at East Carolina. And then he went, you know, after three quick years to, and again, they weren't terrible at ECU. They were okay. And he went to be an assistant for Terry Holland. Well, they were number one in the country at that point. That was when Ralph was still there. Ralph's senior year, you know, they were picked to win the whole thing.
Okay. So let's start there. Okay. So you're how old at this time? This is,
I'm going into third or fourth grade at that point.
Okay, yeah. Like you're like 8 years old.
Yeah.
Ralph Sampson. And like you and I know, and I think a lot of people listen, but there's some people who don't know, like Ralph Sampson was like 3-time player of the year. He's 7'4".
Yeah.
Like crazy skill. And remember, this is in a time when the ACC has Worthy and Jordan, right? And like everybody has NC State had just won a national championship. Like the league is, and he's the best of all. Okay, so 8-year-old Ryan Odom.
Yeah.
What do you remember about like the first, you're looking up at Ralph Sampson?
Yeah, I mean, just shock, you know. I've never seen a guy that tall, number one. And to see the things that he was able to do on the basketball court, I mean, it's what you see all these guys nowadays, and obviously they've taken it to another level in terms of how they play with the ball, you know, in terms of their skill level. But back then when you had big guys, it was all around the rim, you know, it was hook shots, and he certainly had all that. It was dunks and layups, and they would get to the free throw line. But, you know, his ability to shoot and dribble and do the things that he could do on a court was amazing. But I remember the times where he wasn't playing. You know, and I'm at the practice because we literally lived. You've been to Charlottesville and where the, you know, U-Haul was. There's a bridge.
I've never been to Charlottesville.
You've never been?
I'm actually going to go there tomorrow.
Oh my gosh.
I have a day off.
Yeah.
And we'll get back. I apologize for interrupting your story.
No, not at all.
Okay. So the first high major to offer me was Jeff Jones of Virginia.
JJ. I work for JJ.
Okay. So, when he was there, when he offered me, Harold Dean was his point guard.
And
I loved Harold Dean because Harold Dean had like the most, he and Jim Jackson had the most ripped arms ever. Right? Jeez. I was like, those guys are badasses. and so I remember they used to send out, you know, all the mailing stuff, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And so I, you know, like Virginia, Coach Jones offered me a scholarship, and I was still a junior in high school, and at the time it was mostly mid majors, and you know, some tepid interest from some other schools. It was Virginia first, and then Lon Kruger at Florida offered me, but Virginia sent me, so I had got all the stuff, and it was the only school that when they sent all this information, I just poured over it, and I was just fascinated by the campus and the beauty of the campus and everything. And I became like, Bobby Hurley was my idol.
Yeah.
And I didn't know, but I still to this day, I've never been to Cameron. I don't know anything about Duke. I don't know anything about Duke really as a university. But Virginia, I know everything about the buildings and the architecture. Like I was super into it.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff.
Yeah, yeah. But I remember the old arena was a dump, like a complete.
Yeah.
I just remember saying, like, why do they play there?
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
anyway, so it's interesting. It's fascinating that, okay, so you lived close to the –
So there's a bridge that leads, you know, from one little neighborhood over into where the old arena, U-Haul, was. And now they've since torn it down. They've torn down U-Haul. They imploded it a year ago. But the new arena is right beside that. And so literally I would get home. We lived two doors down from the Hollands. And so I grew up with, you know, Coach Holland and Mrs. Holland and their daughters, Ann Michael and Kate. Jim Larinaga was an assistant at the time. So Jay, you know, and I grew up together. Like that was kind of the staff at the time and the kids. Jay and John's Jay's younger brother. And so we had a blast together traveling around, you know, watching them at Final Fours and NCAA tournaments and just all these different, you know, experiences that we all had together growing up. It was really cool. And Coach Holland made it like a true family. But when I would get home from school every day, I would get on my bike and I would ride across the bridge. Sometimes I would walk. I would go to the practices and, you know, literally you think about the practices and the guys that were in the gym at the time. I mean, you had Ralph Sampson, you had Rick Carlisle, you had Othell Wilson, you know, who was an amazing guard and one of the best in the ACC at that time. You had Ricky Stokes, you know, who was incredible to watch. You know, you can keep going with all the players
When did you first start to absorb the actual basketball?
It was probably then. Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, after we'd been there, you know, 3 or 4 years, you know, all of a sudden I'm 12 years old and like I'm working out hard over there and you know, around the team, you know, about when Brian Stith and John Crotty and those guys came in. I mean, that was about the time where, I mean, Crotty was my favorite.
These are good players.
Yeah, I used to try to copy all Crotty's crossovers.
Like, I forgot, like, John Crotty was, I forgot, like, man, he was a stud.
Yeah.
God, he was so good.
He was just a tough dude, too. I mean, he wasn't
Well, that's the thing. And you know, I have an 11-year-old son. And, you know, like, and he's the world's nicest kid.
Yeah.
Like, he's just nice. And I'll never forget, like, he was I've tried to play him up a lot. 11 to playing, like when you get to play 13s, like there's just
a physical difference.
The kids that have post puberty, it's just really hard to fit in there. And he's like me, he'll mature late. I'm still waiting. So when his first time playing like AU basketball,
yeah,
I started coaching this like fourth grade B team. And I had him playing on it. He's like in third grade and he's a young third grader. So instead of just like letting him play, like he couldn't dribble his left hand. He played his left hand. And so I let him dribble right. And then we'd find the other team's point guard. We'd find out he's right, left-handed, make him go the other way the whole game. That's it. I simplify. And I just want you to guard him the entire game. You know, and just every time he gets the ball, make him go to his left hand if he's right handed.
Yeah.
And so we're playing a team and it's fourth graders and he's really frustrating this kid. He's doing a great job and nobody's looking. And at the free throw line, the kid just turns and elbows him right in the head. He goes down to the ground. He's crying. I hate basketball. I don't ever want to play this game. And I said to him then, I say to it now, I said, Hayes, I said, listen, bro. If you want to play this thing,
yeah,
you got to be a tougher than a $2 steak.
That's right.
You got to, if we go through, we track the guys that have made it as backup point guards in the NBA, the guys that we all respect as the great college point guards, like all of them, they have one thing in common.
Yeah.
Some of them are scorers. Some of them are facilitators. Some of them are black. Some of them are white.
Yeah,
they are mixed. They are all the toughest dudes on a basketball court you will ever find. It is just that the nature of you have to be smart, yes, a little bit, but you have to tough is way more important than anything else.
Yeah, you're not going to make it if you're not tough. Like that kid TJ McConnell right now that's still playing. I mean, he's
perfect example.
Tough as nails.
Oh, like look, TJ McConnell. Like I apologize to him every time I see him. Cause I was like, TJ, I told him when he finished school, I was like, you know, like Europe's gonna be hard because you can play, but he plays like a lot of Europeans in terms of his toughness, but they can all really shoot.
Yeah.
They like their own guys. I was like, you know, you should, you know, coaching, whatever. He's like, I'm going to make it. And he's obviously made it. And he's made it because he knows he does what he can do. Just mid-range shots and layups.
Yeah,
get everybody open, and then he just ball goes in the basket, and he's here we go. He just guards, and he's just tough. And they're gonna, you know, they're gonna come at you and try and expose you for your weaknesses every time on defense, and you either decide you want to play or you don't, and that's it.
Yeah.
It's really, you know,
My dad used to always say, there's nowhere to hide. Once you get inside those lines, there's nowhere to hide. Like, it's either you're going to get it done or you're not. And as a team or as an individual, you know, if you're trying to make it as an individual, there's nowhere to hide. It's as fair as it gets.
So Terry Holland had these amazing staffs.
Yeah.
Amazing staffs. I mean, really, like, crazy. You go back kind of, you go back through and look at all his assistants. They've all gone on. They were all successful in coaching and well respected. Why did they not win it all?
I mean, I think you have to be lucky, you know, at times to win it all. And I think that's the short answer of it. You know, they had, you know, that particular year, they ran into a team that caught lightning in a bottle. Like, if NC State didn't exist, Sidney Lowe and Derek Wittenberg and all that crew, they would have won it most likely, you know, that year. And they ran into a team that, you know, would not, there was no give it. And there was just something magical about it. And I think sometimes that's just the way it is. Like, you know, you think about Virginia's run last year, or it's a few years ago now. I mean, they had to escape multiple things had to happen, you know, in each game for them to continue to advance. And so I think, not that, you know, you're saying, oh, they're lucky, you know, but you have to have luck, you know, without a doubt. And the matchups, you know, it's all the matchups, you know, each round, you know, how that plays out. I don't really know the ins and outs of exactly why they didn't beat NC State, but, you know, they had their chances. I know that.
So your dad went where?
So he left there in 1989 and became the head coach at Wake. Yeah, so he was an assistant all the way to 1989, and then took over Wake Forest that year.
What was that like for you to leave? You're like painting a picture of utopia at Virginia, right? Yeah. Great teams. Charlottesville is supposedly amazing.
Yeah,
you know, and great players. And now you're at Wake Forest. And remember, this is again in the league in 1989, where it's Carolina, it's Duke. You know, it's still Virginia and whatever. What were your early memories of when your dad took over Wake?
Yeah, I mean, I can remember going to the press conference, right, at Grayland Conference Center. I mean, it was, you know, it was really exciting because dad had kind of, you know, achieved something that was a dream of his, you know, to be a head coach in the ACC. And it was at a place that he knew really well, where he got his start. He knew all the people there already, you know, and they were excited to, you know, to have him back. And it was an opportunity for him to build something. And, you know, I think one of the biggest things that helped him get it going was being able to sign Rodney Rogers. You know, that was the first sign that, man, they can do something. You know, if this guy's willing to take a chance on Wake, then, you know, we could have something special here.
So your dad gets the Wake job.
Yeah.
Then what was that like for you in terms of your basketball? Now you're middle school into high school, getting ready for high school.
Yeah. So I'm heading into 10th grade at that point. And so, you know, anytime you know, as a coach's son, you move around a lot. And so you have to be, you know, we tried to always look at it as an opportunity as opposed to like, you know, this sucks, man. We're moving again. I just made all my friends here, and now I got to leave all of them. The way we try to view it was, you know, I have more friends now because of this, and let's go make some more. And so that was our, you know, initial thought going in there. And it was a place that we knew.
that's such a parent thing to say, right?
I know.
That's a good one. That's a good one. We'll just make more friends. Like, yeah, I don't know how that works. Yeah, that's before cell phones, Dad. Like, you're literally never going to see these people ever again in your life.
I know. Yeah, you're not the one having to walk into high school, you know, for the first day where you don't know.
Like, plus, you're like now the head coach's son, which is a completely different dynamic.
Yeah, everybody
knows. Assistant coach's son.
Yeah. Yeah, they're looking sideways at you right away.
So, okay. So what high school?
I went to RJ Reynolds, which has turned out to be a blessing for me. It was a great school, awesome school. I played for a coach named Howard West, who's one of the all-time winningest coaches in North Carolina history. Just a great coach, and met some lifelong friends there, man. Lifelong friends.
I got a couple Wake Forest stories. One of them is, do you know that Fran McCaffrey went there as
a freshman? Well, my dad recruited him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So when your dad recruited him, was your dad still there when Fran was there?
He was there for a year, I think. Yeah. And then Fran left. He didn't play that much. And
Well,
wasn't a good
experience. I don't know. Fran, I think Fran said he started as a freshman.
He might have. Yeah, he might have.
And he said his Kyle Tasey story was this one.
Okay? Yeah.
This is a good one. This is a good one. He said he has two of them. Okay. And I've had him on the pod, and he didn't tell it, so I'll tell it for him.
Yeah.
No, he said one was they're playing at Duke, and they had a rule, and you can ask your dad this rule, that when it was on the side, it was on the side, side out of bounds, they were in zone.
Yeah.
Underneath, they're in man.
Okay.
So they're playing at Cameron, the ball goes out of bounds, and it's down close to the corner, but it's on the side.
Yeah.
Underneath out of bounds, they're in zone. Side, they're in man. Right. So, ball goes out of bounds, and it's on the sideline, close to the baseline, but still on the sideline. So, Fran gets his man. They throw the ball in bounds to the elbow, where he's supposed to be if they were in a 2-3 zone, only they're not supposed to be in a 2-3 zone. And Kyle Tasey hops up and get him, and he. So Fran comes over and he's like, why'd you take me out? And he said, and he goes, you don't know. And so he goes in, instead of going and sitting down on the bench, and he goes, coach, we got a rule. Side out of bounds, we're in man. Underneath, we're in zone. And Tasey like wheels back and he's watching the game. And like, it should have been over at that point, but of course, if you know Fran, it's not over. And so Fran says something like, so what you should have done was take those other four assholes out and left me in. So then his other story, this is my favorite one. And I said, I'll never forget, we're sitting in the Joyce Center and we're watching the girls practice. Little did I know that Margaret was a women's coach at the time. Fran was single and they had just started dating or whatever. So watching the women's talk, Muffin McGraw is a great coach, watching practice. And I said, Franny, when did you know you want to coach? And he said, I'll tell you the moment. We're playing in College Park against Maryland. They got Lefty Driesell. We got Kyle Tasey. And they're both good coaches. And 3 seconds left to go in the game. And we're down a point. And we call a timeout. And assistants are arguing over what to run. And by the time Kyle Tasey comes over to draw up a play, the buzzer sounds and the refs are putting us back out in the court. And he turns to me and he's like, Fran, get him in something. So he's like, running two is, right? So they line up and Lefty Driesell looks and he calls the timeout because he wants to adjust to whatever Kyle Tasey threw up. He's like, so I said to myself, wait a second. One guy can't decide what he wants to run. The other guy wants to call a timeout to give the other guy a chance to figure out what he wants to run. He's like, I got to do this. This is the greatest job ever.
We all outthink ourselves. Oh, that's too funny, man.
You're in high school. You're having this great experience. How good were you in high school?
High school, I was solid. Yeah, I mean, I played as a sophomore on the varsity, and then started my last 2 years. My options were walk on at Wake, walk on at Furman. Butch Estes was the coach there.
Great school.
Great school. Or go to Hampton, Sydney, and. I wanted to play, it was still in me, I wasn't ready to kind of give up on the actual action. And, you know, I decided to go to Hampton Sydney and play for Tony Shaver. Tony, you know, was an awesome coach, still is to this day, and a tremendous mentor for me. He was a walk-on for Dean Smith at UNC, and I used to play against Phil Ford every day in practice. And so he taught us all so much, I mean, over the years, and I've still got some of my best friends and memories, you know, from college and games that we had. And you know how it is. You remember, you don't necessarily remember all the games, but you remember all the times together outside of the games. And, you know, we still are on, you know, we still connect with one another, our team, you know, on text and all that from that time.
So now you're starting to form kind of your own basketball identity, right? Because, like, obviously your dad has one style.
Yeah.
High school coach has a style. Tony has a style. You know, when you're a smart thinker, you have an opinion of your own. How did you guys play? Because I think you shot a lot of threes, didn't you guys? You guys played
fast. Yeah, Hampton Sydney, we played the Carolina system. I mean, it was totally the Carolina system. I mean, we pressed, you know, I mean, we would score a basket and we were in 24, what they call 24, which is face guard your guy. And we'd have a guy either on or off the ball. And we were making your life miserable, you know, the entire game, turning you, trapping you, the way they used to play back years ago. And occasionally we would switch to a zone, but that was rare. You know, that was a momentum changer. Offensively, we were motion. He had some sets and all those same sets that they would run, you know, in transition, you know, reverse it, back screen, you know, the lobs, all that kind of stuff. We played Carolina basketball at Hampton Sydney at that level. And, you know, very little scouting of the other team. Like, I don't even really remember a ton of scouting for the other. I know they did it. But it was all about us. It was never about, like, the other team. They're going to have to beat us. And, you know, he was just a really, really good coach. And it was a fun time in my life.
So you get done playing.
Yeah.
And then now you're just – was it only basketball? I mean, like, look, that's a great school.
Yeah, I mean, my thought initially, I did an internship my junior year, in between my junior and senior year at Bank of America in Charlotte. And I worked for my godfather all summer on the trading floor. And so I thought about going into the financial. That was my initial goal. I was an econ major. I thought about going into financial world. And, you know, while I enjoyed it that summer, I wasn't ready to give up hoops. And, you know, as I got later into my senior year, you know, it was apparent that I wanted to coach. And my father was kind of at the height of his career. You know, they had won back-to-back ACC championships with Duncan, Childress, and those guys. And then, you know, my brother was coaching, you know, at Alabama. You know, they had Sprewell and Horry and all those James Hollywood Robbins.
Dude.
I mean, they actually, little known fact, my brother and my father played against one another in the NCAA tournament. You know, Alabama played Wake Forest,
yeah,
which was pretty cool. But you know, it was apparent that I wanted to do that, and your old buddy Seth Greenberg gave me a chance down at South Florida, and helped me get into the business, and then gave me my second job or my third job at Virginia Tech, third or fourth, yeah. So
the
he tried to recruit you, didn't he?
Did so he recruited me to Long Beach initially coming out, like, you know, yeah. My dad had been we moved out to California because my dad was an assistant under Tex Winter at Long Beach, and I mean, he had it going at Long Beach State.
He had it was a
big time program in a small time league, and but part of it was I really, you know, I wanted to go to UCLA and they offered me, but it was just there was some baggage there in terms of them not offering me early, and they had taken a commitment from a kid a year behind me, and I didn't feel it. And I maybe wanted to get away as well. Like, you know, I've moved back since to California, but there's a reason that I wanted to get away. I love basketball, but I want to play somewhere where they love basketball, where they care about it. It's more of a college atmosphere. and it took a second stop to get there. But when I transferred, he and Dave Z, they put on the full court press to South Florida.
Yeah.
You know, we were going to have Minion. We were going to have all the Jews gather in Tampa and be at South Florida. And so
yeah, what year was that? Cause I think I might've been there.
96 and 96, 97. I sat out.
Yeah. So I went there in 97, his first year I was there. Yeah.
Right. So he did like two home visits.
Yeah.
It was a weird, he would like did a home visit and then he was like, he's like, I forgot some stuff. And I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. Like there was an ego part to it that I wasn't willing to give up the high major thing or whatever.
Sure.
And it wasn't anything personal. Seth, I love Seth. But Seth coaches very differently especially differently than your dad.
Yeah.
Terry Holland and Tony Shaver. What did you take from that experience when you're just getting into the business?
Yeah. I mean, for him, he wasn't afraid of anybody, you know. I think he's not that he's going to outwork, because everybody works hard in college basketball. Like there's a lot of hard workers out there. He works really smart. And you know, it's almost like you have your back against the wall. He's got this underdog team and he knew what it was going to take, with his team to get them to fight and be tough to a certain level. To be competitive, and not only be competitive, but to win. I mean, like what he did at Virginia Tech, you know, and, you know, his time there, you know, he got that program going again. It had fallen on hard times, you know, had some transition in terms of moving leagues and all of that. And he just infused this immediate energy and no fear. And, you know, it got to the students.
But how? How do you do it? How do you infuse toughness and energy and belief when it doesn't exist?
Yeah. I mean, I think initially it's, you know, the recruiting side of things, you know, you have to, we were fortunate in that, you know, when he first got there, he ended up signing Xavier Dowdell, who he was recruiting at South Florida. Xavier turned out to be an all ACC performer. He was just a hard worker and had no fear and had a chip on his shoulder and wanted to prove people wrong. So I think that's one of the first ways that you do it, is you have to have others within your program that feel like they've been, you know, slighted a little bit and they have something to prove. And we had a group of guys that felt that way. Jamon Gordon was his backcourt mate. I mean, Jamon Gordon was recruited by the Georgia Techs and some of these other schools, you know, overlooked probably by his local schools in Florida State and Florida and Miami. And he came up to Virginia Tech and it was open for them to play because, you know, we didn't have anybody else really at that point. And, you know, they just took it. Those two guys took it and ran with it. And we had a young player in Coleman Collins who just kind of grew into an amazing role and became a dominant, you know, player for us. And we just kept recruiting, you know. I think one of the things that, you know, he really tried to do was play off of the success that football had already established.
Right.
Like there's a built-in fan base at a football school like that, you know, Virginia Tech. And so all of the cheers and the things that they were excited about, you know, we tried to move into Castle Coliseum and the students already were excited about the university as a whole. Like you walk around that school, you don't see any other shirts. You know, there's certain schools where it's like, you know, Wake, for instance, you know, they're just mixed allegiances in that community. It's not Wake's fault. It's just, you know, you have UNC, you have Duke and Carolina and NC State. They're all so close together. Naturally, there's mixed allegiances. Well, in a place like a college town like you're talking about, there aren't any. Like everybody's for that school. And so
you don't play on that. You don't wear another color. Like that's the thing that I think people don't. If you haven't been a part of it, you don't understand. Like if you live in Stillwater or you're an Oklahoma State person, you don't own anything that's red. You don't own anything that's red. Any shade of red, you just don't own. Everything you have, like you fall back on orange, right? Like that's just the way it works. And whether it's maroon or orange or whatever, when you're Virginia Tech, like that's all you own. You're like, you're just all in.
Yeah. And so he was able to play on that. And, you know, he's obviously a great motivator, a great, you know, communicator. And, you know, he made it a point to get to know the students, you know, to really get out in the community and you know, be a voice, you know, for the basketball program. Hey, we're here too. We're trying to do something special, you know, just get on board with us. And the players obviously did the bulk of the work. You know, they began to have success and play a tough brand of basketball that community really fell in love with. Like, his teams were tough, and that was all built in practices and just the work ethic, you know, that he established. And, you know,
So then you went where?
Left there and went to UNC Charlotte and worked for Alan Major at UNC Charlotte. So he was just leaving Ohio State. They'd been in the Final Four. And at that point, Charlotte was in the Atlantic 10. And they were adding Butler and VCU and all the other teams that, you know, I know Butler's since left, but are currently in the league. And I mean, it was a big time league, and it was a big time opportunity for me. It was a chance for me to go work for a guy who was going to be a first time head coach. And so I wanted to do that again, you know, and it was home, you know, as well. I hadn't worked in North Carolina in a long time. My brother worked there for Lutz. And so I knew the history of the program.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like it was a Xavier kind of situation, you know.
It was for a while. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was. I mean, they were competitive with Cincinnati and Louisville and all those teams. And you know, while we didn't achieve everything that we wanted to achieve while we were there, we recruited some great guys and you know, had a good experience without a doubt. I wouldn't trade that experience for anything.
You took over as interim.
I did. Yeah. My last year. Yeah.
What first, take me through the experience of when a coach, and I think he had some health issues too, right? And then,
yeah.
And then, how does it go down, or how did it go down for you in that, you know, the AD comes in and says like, hey, you're the guy.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was
just the AD. How did it all work?
Yeah. I mean, it was the AD ended up, you know, communicating that to all of us. But at the same time, Alan was intimately involved in that, you know, in terms of, you know, spearheading that and what he thought was best for the program. But there are other experienced assistant coaches on that staff. I mean, Desmond Oliver, Orlando Vandross, both, you know, are friends to this day. And, you know, I think our approach was, we're just going to do this together. While I have to actually be the interim head coach, we're going to do this thing together. That's the only way it's going to work. And I didn't want that separation. And so we kind of kept doing our jobs, you know. You know, we had the respect of the players and you know, obviously all three of us had kind of been intimately involved. We recruited together there a little bit differently than some other places that I've worked, where it's like, hey, you go recruit this guy and he's your guy and whatever. You know, we recruited together. So that part of it was not an issue. You know, our whole goal was to do the best for those players that we could do, while understanding that, you know, their leader was going to be gone for a bit. And we didn't know how long it would be. It ended up being that entire season, or not entire season, but from January on, for the remainder of the year. And that was a hard ending for us. You know, I think we were, I don't remember exactly what our record was, but we lost in the first round of the tournament in a really close game. I think it might have been to Middle at the time. I can't remember who it was. But anyway, we were like 8-11. You know, we weren't great, obviously, but we weren't terrible either. We had some really good players, you know, at that point. A lot of them went on to high majors after, you know, Alan and us were let go. And, you know, we it was a tough ending for us for sure. And that was a dark time for me personally, getting fired. So, you coach long enough, you're going to get fired. You know, it's just the way it is.
So that's why I asked. Okay. So, you know, I think one of the hard things it for fans and the media is the understanding of like when people get fired. Like we just we very callously go like, well, he should get fired and he makes a bunch of money. Like, hold on, man, you got all these assistant coaches and while they're making decent livings, like they gotta go home and they have wives and kids and they're gonna move and they gotta try and go find a job. Like it is okay, so what do you remember about losing you lose your job in Charlotte? Then what's that?
Yeah. I mean, I was devastated, you know, I was devastated. I felt like I let Allen down, you know, the players, you know, and obviously circumstances, you know, we could have won some of the games we lost, but we didn't, you know, and, you know, it is what it is. The results were the results and no hard feelings. Obviously they made the decision that they felt was right for the, you know, the program at the time. And still have a good relationship with the folks there at Charlotte. But, you know, for me personally, the biggest issue that I had going on, you know, in my family was my son was sick. You know, it's been pretty well documented. Connor has OCD. And so my wife was not hiding, but she was really during that time where I was the interim coach, she was trying to keep it off of me. And but he was getting worse, you know, as every day went. And, you know, it got to a point where the season ended and he was really, really bad. And, I remember one weekend I had to take my youngest and go down to Charleston just to get him out of the house. Owen, you know, just to get him away from, you know, seeing Connor in a bad state. And Lucy just obviously was an amazing force for Connor and led us through that. And that's the hard deal. You know, they had two different stints, you know, in Nashville, Tennessee, doing therapy, you know, at a hospital. And so she had to get up and move all the way out there with him, rent an apartment, which obviously costs money. You know, you think about that, like all of a sudden we're fired, no job. She's got to move to Nashville, you know, and we got bills to pay, you know, those aren't going anywhere. And during that time, I think he left in August and he and Lucia left in August and I had accepted a job at Lenoir Rhyne University. I was very fortunate to get that job and as a Division II head job, you know, at a place that, you know, to this day, I wouldn't be where I'm at, you know, had I not been presented with that opportunity, you know, and I'm forever thankful for that, for sure. Saved our lives.
Okay, so now you have your own program.
Yeah.
And you've been at all sorts of different levels. You have your family and you're trying to figure that out. How'd you put together your first team at Rhyme?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I was lucky again, you know, I followed a coach in John Lentz, you know, who had been there for 28 years and great coach. He's Rick Barnes's teammate, you know, and they both played at Lenoir Rhyne. And he was a coach that, you know, I don't know how to describe him, but like his players knew exactly what he wanted. He was a tough coach. Right. And so the team that I inherited was very disciplined. And for a young coach to come in that capacity to inherit guys, I mean, they were already trained. He had well trained them. And so I walked into a great situation. Maybe we didn't have exactly, you know, the talent, you know, that some of the other programs in that conference had. But we were able to recruit and add a couple of guys that, you know, when combined with the returners, ended up being, you know, a storybook season for us. And, you know, I found just some amazing players there. Still have amazing relationships with those guys to this day. Forever grateful for them, you know, for all their hard work. But that was a fun year, man. Sweet 16, had some great, great memories.
So you inherited a tough team, maybe not as talented as others in that league, and then I lost.
Yeah, we recruited, and then we added to that. We recruited a kid named Keenan Palmore, who was transferring from Old Dominion and Jeff Jones. And he had 1 year remaining, and he played for Old Dominion. He was kind of a you know, I don't know what you would call it, backup maybe or whatever. He wasn't a full-time starter. He did start some games, but, you know, heading into his senior year, it was apparent he was going to be a backup, and he didn't want to do that. And he found us in Lenore Ryan. And, you know, that connection was very strong. He ended up being an All-American. He had four or five triple-doubles, you know, that year. I mean, he was just an amazing player. And he came into a group of guys with no ego. It was all about – he was an amazing passer. You'll love this about him. Like, he literally made, like, 2 3-pointers the entire year. And our team shattered the three-point record, you know, for the conference, you know, all time. Shattered the record for Lenore Ryan. And we were number one in Division II in three-pointers made per game at, like, right at 13, just under 13. But it was all because of him. Like, he was getting guys shots over and over and over again. He would just get in the lane and get it to him. But he also knew that he wasn't a three-point shooter. And so he ended up taking two shots at the end of shot clocks. and I was and one of them went in. And I was hoping he was going to get a whole season and not make one. I was actually pulling for that. Because what a story, right? You know, everybody shoots the three now. And it's like, care. Like, he just wanted to get in the lane and, you know, and play to his strengths. But that was one of the reasons that we won.
And so what was your decision like to leave there?
You know, it was a hard decision. It was an emotional decision because I'd found some guys there that had changed my life and I loved dearly. But at the same time, you know, I understood that, you know, coaching, being a head coach in Division I is a hard thing. It's hard to get those jobs. And there are only 344 or whatever that number is of them. And it's very competitive. And when you have an opportunity to do it, you know, I'm a big believer. Yeah, they're good jobs. There are certain jobs are better than others, but there's no bad Division I. You go make it. You can make it what you want to make it. And, you know, I felt like UMBC was a great time to go here. You know, it had some hard times, but they were building a brand new arena. We're in a geographic footprint that, you know, basketball is important, like you were talking about. And, you know, I felt like, you know, we could build something special here.
So what was your first team like?
First team, again, I inherited a group that are just great guys. You know, I had guys on the team that were 4.0 students. I had guys that had transferred. One transferred from VCU who ended up being, you know, probably my best player, you know, who just happened there. As I began to have my meetings with the players, while they hadn't won together at UMBC, one common theme was they had all won other places. You know, one had played at Brewster Academy with Donovan Mitchell, you know, and they didn't lose a game. You know, another one played at DeMatha, you know, and won championships. And so as I went through that team, they all won elsewhere. And so it was all about – and the coaches had won elsewhere. And so it was all about – we made it, hey, let's win together now. We all know what it feels like to win. Let's make sure that we're doing that every day. So my whole thing was we're going to establish a winning culture, and that means we got to compete to win every day. And we compete with one another first, and we prepare, you know, for our opponents, and then we begin to compete against them.
Okay, so this is – and again, if you're tight on time, you tell me. So this is what's fascinating to me. There hasn't been a – job that you've gone to where, and again, you know, there's probably some guys you're not mentioning, but most coaches confide in coaches and people like me, and they're like, you know, wait till I get my guys in here, right? And you know, and they run guys off, they call them in, and they say, like, look, man, you're a great kid, you're just never gonna play here, yada yada yada, and they just buy time until their recruits come in, and now they're all in, which I always find to be a mistake.
Yeah.
Is that why do you not seem to have that approach? Is it because of the guys that preceded you left you, or is it that it's just a philosophical belief that you have?
Yeah, I think it's a belief. I mean, for sure. I mean, they chose that school for a reason, and, you know, they chose those coaches, and they have a right to, if they want to leave, you know, when you first get there, then that's fine. I'm not trying to hold anybody here. But if they want to stay, I want them to be able to, they have their scholarship. They want to do that. I want them to do that. But they're going to be a part of this program and do it the way we ask them to do it and all that. But, you know, I believe retention is a key thing, you know, in any college basketball program or any endeavor for that matter. You know, when you have folks that, you know, are all in, you want to keep them. You know, you look at all the great college football and basketball programs over the years, you know, the head coach stays there, the assistant coaches, you know, for the most part stay there unless they're moving on to head jobs. Those are the teams that usually win. And if you have a lot of volatility and change every year, and I know it's going to be harder, you know, as they change these rules. I mean, it is what it is. Retention's a huge thing, you know. Virginia Tech football is like that.
I guess this is an honest question, but why do we – we seem to let these exterior forces be a part of this change when – you and I have been around this our entire lives, and we know that's actually not. And look, I'm a transfer, okay? But I was, before I even got, they found out I got in trouble, I was considering transferring. So I'm not saying that I think there's maybe another discussion. I think that one of the biggest issues is that you don't get enough time to truly recruit somebody and know that kid and him know you so that when he shows up on campus, you actually know what you got on both sides, right?
Yeah.
And I think that would help. But it feels like we're all like, you know, just the times that you're gonna be able to transfer and not sit out. Like, why? Like, because somebody on Twitter who's never been a part of it doesn't understand that every freshman wants to transfer.
Yeah.
They either want to transfer to the NBA or to another school. Right? Because but you know what else? Almost every college kid wants to transfer. Because your freshman year is hard.
It's hard.
Really hard.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard. The classes are hard.
Yeah.
You're away from home. You have to manage a budget. You have to manage your time. You have to manage your relationships. Like, it's really hard.
And imagine what it's like in a pandemic. You know, like, I feel for the kids that are freshmen right now. This is their first experience in college. My son's one of them.
Right.
And it's just, you know, it's not normal. You know, you're getting your nose poked and tested constantly. And, you know, you got to go back to your dorm room or wherever you live. And, you know, I can't be exposed to anyone. It's just not a normal situation. And, you know, it's everybody sacrificed it. And certainly this year, you know, hopefully it'll get back to normal at some point.
Okay. So how'd you make it hit? Like when did it, like, this is going to work?
Yeah. I mean, I think that first year, I mean, I called that team the foundational team, you know, and we compared it to a house. You know, when you establish a foundation, that foundation's got to be strong. It can't have any cracks in it. And I inherited some great guys. And I think going back to the culture thing, you know, trying to create a winning culture and, you know, going back to what you said, it's not about what the previous staff did or saying, oh, they had a bad culture or whatever. We're trying to change the culture. No, we're not trying to do that. We're trying to establish our own winning culture. I don't care what happened before. I want to make sure that every day that they come in here, they're trying to win. And, you know, that means against one another, whether it's a one-on-one drill or whatever it is, like, we're going to be competitive. And if you're not, you're fooling yourself, because when the game happens, you're going to get beat, you know, on a regular basis. And, you know, this game is played with physicality. It's played, you know, with the physical side of things, but it's also played, you know, on the mental side of things. And if you don't have both, you know, you're going to get beat. And so we spend a lot of time, you know, with our guys working on both. And, you know, and then, you know, I think distractions are a big part of why teams don't win. And I was very fortunate in that first year, did not have many distractions in terms of off the court things that can derail, you know, a team and its ability to go for it. These guys were all in. And yeah, we weren't great, but we still won 21 games. They had won prior to that 7 straight 20 loss seasons. And so this team, you know, had the biggest turnaround in Division I, you know, that year. And, you know, while we didn't win our goal or make the NCAA tournament, it was evident that everybody was coming back and we had a chance to be really good that next year. Now we were going to still have to beat, you know, a Vermont team. It was spectacular, you know.
So sometimes when guys come back, it's not a good thing, right?
Yeah.
Because they have everybody expects more.
You know?
Fans expect more, but everybody expects more. What was that next year like?
Well, the next year was the NCAA tournament year. We got off to a good start. We did have a few injuries, you know, where Jairus missed a game or two, Jordan missed a game or two, my kind of guards there. KJ missed the first two games. It was the starting point guard, when we played Arizona and SMU. And so, you know, I knew we had a chance when we were playing Arizona. And, you know, they couldn't really separate from us until the very end. They would get out, 8-9 points, and then all of a sudden we'd close it back, you know, and then halftime we're down 7 or 8 or something like that. Then they'd get it out to 16, and then all of a sudden it's 3, you know. That particular team was resilient, and we played that particular game without KJ Mara, who ended up – who was our point guard. He was kind of the maestro of the whole team. And we were still in it. And so I felt like this particular team had a chance, you know, to do something special, at least in the non-conference, told me that. And then once we got into conference play, we were pretty consistent. You know, we lost, even though we lost to Vermont twice, we only lost one other game, I think, in conference play. And so we knew, you know, if we wanted to make it, eventually we were going to have to go through Vermont, you know, at that point. And, obviously we were able to do that in the final game.
What's that experience like? Because everybody focuses on the Virginia game.
Yeah.
But the Vermont game gets you actually, like, that's the big one. That's the one. Yeah. The rest is icing.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that game?
Yeah, I mean, it was just a hotly contested game. The place is packed, obviously. I think we're up maybe a couple at half. And we were fortunate to be up. I mean, they were playing well. We made some shots at the end of the half just to kind of eke that out. What I remember most is KJ, our point guard, getting his fourth foul with about 8 minutes to go or 12 minutes to go. And I was like, oh crap, we're in trouble here. And we kind of lucked into something, you know, that particular game. I put him back in early and I changed the matchup, you know, for who he was going to guard. I put him on a shooter, you know, which wasn't a normal thing for us. You know, he always guarded the other team's point guard. He was defensive player of the year that year, even though he's 5'7". And so he would always pester, like your son, pester the other team's point guard. And Vermont had a great point guard that year. Trevell Haynes was spectacular. He was hard to pester. And we ended up moving the matchup and put a bigger guy on Bell Haynes, and KJ ended up guarding the shooter. And so it allowed him to kind of stay in the game longer, you know, without risking a foul. And so that was a huge key. And then at the end, you know, obviously Jairus was Jairus. Jairus worked really hard for that moment. And, you know, I couldn't have been more proud of him and the growth that he showed over the 2 years that I was fortunate enough to coach him. He was a great player, a great scorer, dynamic player. He was the best player in the league to me that year, even though he didn't get player of the year. And for him to have the ball at the end of the game in that moment was the right thing. And it was the way it should have ended. And, I wanted to run another play, and KJ's yelling at me, no, don't run that play because it would have required him to give the ball up. And so I had to trust those guys.
What did you want to run?
So I wanted to run just one of our plays called Euro 2, where, you know, KJ starts it and then he flips it back to Jairus. Jairus gets it, you know, a pick and roll, ball screen comes out, and then he's able to kind of get downhill and make the play.
So what
ended up happening? It would have required – Jairus already had the ball, and I knew I wasn't calling timeout.
Right.
And so
– Now, is that typically your style in terms of not calling a timeout?
Usually, you know, I like my guys to be able to know what to do in those instances. Not to say that I won't call timeouts. I certainly will, you know, if it's not going well. But at the same time, you know, I like to be able to coach from the side there where they can't get it set. And yes. I like to go and trust my guys. And that particular team, I had no reason not to trust them. You know, I had three really good guards that, you know, knew what to do. And
I've never understood. There's lots of coaches who, like, not only you practice this all year, you play it all year, you're right in front of your bench.
Yeah.
And yet they want to call a timeout, which allows the other guy to set their defense. Like, I don't understand. I really, for the life of me, don't understand philosophically.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, you want to get somebody in or whatever for a matchup.
Yeah.
But I don't understand. Anyway, okay, so he has the ball. What's
my job at that point was to get everybody the hell out of the way.
That's good coaching. Good coaching.
Get it space, baby. Get it space. Let him go. And he delivered, you know, he delivered. So it's not complicated, right? It's simple.
So double zeros in the clock.
Yeah.
Okay. You look up at the scoreboard, you look at your family, like what do you remember about the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I remember hugging my kid. I remember hugging my wife, you know, and every player. You know, I remember having a moment with my AD, you know, who believed in me and our staff. He's crying, you know, we're all crying. My best friend in the world, Griff Aldridge, who's now the coach of Longwood, you know, was a lawyer and my college teammate. Decided he wanted to coach, you know. So he came with me when I first came to UMBC, and so he and I were hugging big time. You know, to have that experience with your best friend, you know, it's pretty cool. And so it was an emotional time. I mean, that game was way more emotional than, you know, the Virginia game, obviously. Not obviously, but for us it was, because you know how it is. It comes down to that one weekend. Like, you have the best season. We just experienced it. It comes down. We were the number one seed. We got knocked out. You know, the other team gets hot at the end and in the last 8 minutes. And hey, the season's over. You walk in the locker room and it's like, what just happened? You know, it's crazy.
So you get back and that championship's a little bit early, right?
Yeah.
So now you gotta get ready. What was Selection Sunday like?
Selection Sunday was fun. You know, they had a big party on campus and, you know, the typical thing. CBS wanted to do the in-person, whatever, live look-in, you know, with us, you know, because it was our first time going to the tournament since 2008. And we had a crazy ending, obviously, in the conference final. And so that was great. And then, you know, we see Virginia's name pop up. I was expecting, quite honestly, to be 15. We had a good team that year. I felt our numbers would be such that we would be in that 15 line. And so I was really thinking Duke, you know, I was thinking some of those teams that were on the two line that we would end up playing. And so I was a little bit shocked. And I did we all did a collective gulp and gasp when we saw Virginia. Because they were just so good that year. I mean, they were so good. And we didn't know Hunter was going to be out at that point, you know. So it was just – and for me, a lot of emotions because I grew up there. You know, going back to that, you know, I grew up there. It's where I first fell in love with hoops, you know, got a lot of respect for Tony and his staff. So it was – that part was kind of crazy.
You know, and the bridge and everything – Terry Holland staff. Yeah. Okay, so you throw in the tape.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there with your staff. What'd you think?
Yeah, I mean, I thought this is the best team in college basketball. They're the most well-balanced team on both sides of the ball. You know, are we going to be able to score 36? You know, I mean, that's the reality. That's what every coach, when you're getting ready to play Virginia, it's like, you know, they may not go to 80 on you, all right, but can you get to 40? You know, I mean, that's the reality. You know, they're going to get the 60, most likely. They're probably going to get the 70 if they want. They don't really go past that very often, or at least in that era they didn't. You know, I'd seen them play teams earlier in the year that they held the 36 points, NCAA tournament teams. And so we knew we had a tough, tough task, a tough draw. One of the things that helped us with that draw was weeks of preparation, you know, for Vermont. You know, they play a similar brand of defense. You know, they guard you hard, but they don't allow threes. You know, they guard the two extremely well at the rim. Their rotations are pristine. And so we had a lot of prep, you know, leading into the Virginia game against that type of defense. And that certainly helped us offensively.
When did you know Hunter was up?
Not until we were on the plane going down there. Yeah, so that was probably on a Wednesday, maybe 2 or 3 days before the game, something like that. I think that's about when we figured it out.
All right, so you land, and all of a sudden you're like, wait a second, hold on, that was a big deal.
Yeah, that was a big deal. Yeah, because whenever they needed a basket, they were going to him. You know, and sometimes it was a post up. You know, whatever. If it ever got dicey, you know, they were running something to get him the ball in and near the basket or in kind of a mid post area or up near the elbow in an ISO situation. And so I knew he would be a problem. Not that I felt like we could guard all the other guys, but you know, I knew that had the potential to change it somewhat, you know, at least it certainly didn't hurt. Let's just say that.
But it also defensively changed them because now they had to play two traditional bigs.
Yeah.
And you know, so, okay. So, you know, I know how it works. I've been in those locker rooms, and I've never been in a locker room where, you know, couldn't make you believe you had a chance.
Yeah.
And that if you execute the game plan, like, we're going to win this game, fellas, and here's how we're going to do it. And you're like, we're going to do it. And what was the belief level like from your team in your prep?
I knew never to doubt that particular team. You know, I wasn't saying that we, you know, I would never say that we knew we were going to win the game. You know, our goal was to be competitive in the game and to be in the game and to have a chance at the end. I mean, that was really our whole focus. Obviously, the result ended up being totally different, you know, than what anybody ever imagined. But it was all about how are we going to stay in it on offense and defense? And we felt like defense was the way for us to stay in the game, to be honest. Like we knew scoring on them was going to be insanely difficult. And so we felt like we had a very good defensive team that year. And our goal was pressure those guards as much as you can and not allow them to center the ball. I mean, that was kind of our whole thing.
So you felt like your defense was the way in which you'd win. You'd win the game, right?
Yeah. So I felt like defense was our way to stay in the game. Like I didn't want our guys. Like when you play a Virginia team, frustration sets in. You know how it is. You're a player. Like if you're not scoring, sometimes that can impact
your defense breaks down.
And so that was our whole message to them. Like we can't get seduced into an offensive game against them or get frustrated because our offense isn't going well. We have to guard every single possession like it's the last one. And we did some specific things relative to them and how they run that mover blocker and all that. We felt like we needed to pressure them. We had seen a lot of teams just back up, you know, and not get after them. We had seen a lot of teams not try to run on them, you know, as well, because they do a good job of getting back on defense and transition. And I wanted our guys to take the opportunities early in transition if they were there, because you're not just going to be able to hold the ball against them and move it around and get a great shot. Like sometimes the best shot you can get against them is early. And so I wanted our guys to try to do that. And if they had it, let's roll with it. But at the same time, don't take a bad one. We practiced all week shooting against hands, you know, and pressure because they're always going to be there pretty much in front of you, and you're going to have, we practice well behind the line shooting threes because we knew, you know, those are the shots that you can get against them. We were honest with our team about like, if you're going to win this game, you're going to have to outshoot them and you're going to have to keep them from shooting threes. It can't just be take away the rim and then all of a sudden they're getting 10 threes as well. Just like us, we're not going to win with that. And so we had to take away their three, defend like crazy, and rebound. And we had to make threes, you know, and layups, basically. I mean, that's really the gameplay. Wasn't much more than that.
Like you also, you spread them out.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I mean,
we changed our angles on our ball screens and all of that. We didn't set middles, you know, because they're so well schooled at stepping out. We set all flats. That was kind of the game plan there.
I think that's one thing though that, like, you know, now a couple years later, maybe you still don't get credit for. It wasn't just because people go back, well, they didn't have DeAndre Hunter, so. You know, like,
yeah.
No, you guys did some specific things
that
made it really way more difficult. You knew how, because they were, and this is where I had a long conversation with Tony like a week later. And my message to him was like, you can't just do what you do. And you have to try different things, play left-handed some, you know, figure out a way. I mean, like, okay, Hunter gets hurt. What lineups had you tried all year long? In case, what if he got three fouls in the first half? You know,
yeah.
What if a kid is sick, and what if a team knows what you do and designs and has personnel to execute and make you chase them? So I think you don't. To this day, we don't cover things the way I just wish there was like a college basketball matchup show where I go like.
Yeah.
It wasn't just that they made a bunch of threes. It was they did some things specifically
together that
were fascinating
and
that you should get credit for. Okay, so you get to the game. Games can be won and lost in layup lines.
No question.
When the guys start peeking, they go, holy shit, they look good. And we don't. When you looked your team in the eye, what did you see when you're standing in front of them?
Yeah, I mean, I saw a bunch of guys that had been overlooked and that were, including myself, you know, that, you know, had an opportunity. And I felt like there was a reason that we were in that building at that moment. What that reason was, I wasn't quite sure. I didn't necessarily think that we were going to win the game going into that, right? And while I'm giving that speech, but my speech to them prior to that game was a thankful one. I thank those guys for bringing me and my family back to Charlotte, where I was let go. That was it. You know, I just said, look, you know, this business is extremely hard. In a lot of ways, we all have our own stories, right? Jarris started at VCU with Shaka, didn't go well. He ends up at Robert Morris, stays there for half the year, then he lands at UMBC. KJ, you know, gets let go at Texas A&M Corpus Christi and, you know, has to go to JUCO for a year, you know, rehabilitates himself, and then he doesn't have a Division I offer except for us and ends up there. Joe Sherber had one D1 offer, you know, and it was UMBC. Like, you go around the room and it was just like a bunch of overlooked guys, you know, that had a story. And I said, we're all here in this moment together. We've done this together, you know, at this time. And you guys in particular have done this for me. And so I'm forever grateful, you know, for what you guys have done. Now let's go out there and just show everybody our passion and belief in one another, you know, that we can compete with this team. And, you know, I shed some tears, I'll be quite frank with you, you know, while I was giving that speech, and it was very emotional. And that was, you know, not the first time I do that with my team, not all the time, but, you know, I'm real with them. You know, I think they appreciated that. They understood the message. And more than anything, they were ready. They knew they had an opportunity to make history. And so they wanted to go for it. And, you know, there were some bumps in that first half, but the defense kept us in. You know, it was 21-21. Both teams.
Okay, so 21-21.
Yeah.
And I remember I'm sitting there watching the game, and I'm with a group of guys, and I go, they got them. And they're like, it's like, Virginia's going to kick their ass in the second half. You know how this goes, right? Like, they got, I said, they can't guard them.
Yeah.
They can't, they're too quick. They can't guard the ball.
Yeah.
You know, and it's what we always learn and we try and tell kids all the time. It's like, hey man, you want to get on the floor.
Yeah.
The first thing you have to be able to do is guard the basketball.
Yeah.
Right. And it's the best thing that they do at Virginia. And I felt like you had them spread out. They were kind of chasing. They were chasing you. And I was like,
yeah.
If they could just hit a couple jump shots, you know, they can't, it's a bad matchup because you got their bigs 30 feet from the basket chasing you around. And what's the name of that big white kid that Virginia had? He had a great name.
Jack Salt. Yeah.
Jack Salt. Right. Jack Salt is a great name. And I had done their game, I think earlier in the year when they had played in Destin, Florida.
Yeah.
And I loved him. And I was just like, yeah, but you know, those tough twos, you know, back to the basket, post up twos, like there's a reason analytics tell you those are a tough shot.
Yeah.
And you guys were playing the post right. I was like, I don't think Jack Salt can score 20. And I think that you guys can hit some threes. And the guys around like, nah, watch this shit. They're going to, you know, BC is going to score 10 in the second half. Okay. So you come in at half. Okay.
Yeah.
And the way it works is, hey, the players run in and you meet your staff. What'd your staff say?
I think they were optimistic. You know, I mean, they always give really good thoughts. I mean, we talk about offense first and then we talk about the defense and just little things that we need to pay attention to. And so really halftime was about, you know, highlighting things that we tried to do going into the game. Did we actually get them done in the first half or did we not? I thought we did. You know, I felt like we were good on the glass. They got a couple of offensive rebounds, but we were pretty solid there. I think offensively, you know, our pressure was solid. You know, they weren't able to just get into the paint constantly on us, you know. And I felt like our ability to navigate the screens, like that was a big, we worked on that a ton. All right. Navigating, defending that mover blocker, because, you know, you go, as soon as you go the wrong way, they make you pay with a three.
Right.
And so our goal was, We compared it to Tom Brady. If you let Tom Brady sit back in the pocket as the point guard and just, you know, see everything, he's going to pick you apart. And so we said, pressure the guy. I don't care who it is. If the big guy has it out top, if the point guard has it, whoever that guy is that's going from the wing, centering the ball, try to keep him on his side and just pressure the crap out of him just to disrupt the timing of their screening angles. And to give the defender time to get through. And so we worked on that a ton. And I thought that was pretty successful for us. You know, we were always kind of there when they caught the ball. I mean, that was the key. I don't care which way you go, just be right there when they catch it.
Right.
And, you know, I thought that was a big key for us. And then offensively, our guys felt like, hey, we missed some shots out there. You know, we can get some shots against them. We just got to knock them in. And, you know, we got off to a good start right out of the gate at a halftime, and which was not something that I hadn't seen before with this team. This team is, you know, they've been tied at half and then come out and gone on runs, you know, big runs, you know, at times during the season. But I would also say it wasn't an unnatural position for Virginia either. They've been tied or down one or up two plenty of times. You know, like, so for them, there was no reason for concern at that point. It was just, hey, we're going to win the game. You know, we're going to figure it out. So,
when did you know?
I probably knew that we had a significant chance around that 8-minute timeout right in there. Like we had a solid chance because we'd gone up so much, and I had seen our team. My job at that point was, hey, don't take the foot off the gas, because as soon as you take the foot off the gas, you start coughing the ball up, you know, they lay it up, you know, because they're going to change the way that they're playing. Like, they're going to come after you. They're going to foul you more. You're going to hope that the refs don't call it. They're just going to go for it. They're going to shoot it quicker. Can we get the rebounds, you know, because they're shooting it quicker, like all of those things. Play forward. I think that's what I kept saying. Play forward. Take it when it's there. And, you know, the guys ended up doing that.
And the again, the parts of the story that aren't told enough are, it wasn't like you hit a miracle shot.
Yeah.
Right. It wasn't like things that go, you got a crazy call. It was a no doubter. It was a blowout. What are those moments like as you're looking up and no, it's because I'll just, and I know, again, I understand you've been gracious for your time. My first game calling a game in the NCAA tournament, or second, excuse me, was Southern against Gonzaga. And Gonzaga ended up losing the next game to Wichita, but it was tied, or Southern was leading with 4 minutes to go. And I'm sitting there with Spiro Ditas, and we're sitting there going, holy shit, like we're going to call the first 16. And, you know, Southern's got this incredible band, but it's in Salt Lake City, and suddenly there's like 16,000 Southern fans. You're like, what is going on?
Going nuts.
Right? Right? Yeah. So what are those minutes like? It's like 5 minutes to go. You're up 15 on Virginia. No one's ever done it before. You're kicking their ass. They're chasing you around. Like what it's out of body experience. What is that like?
I mean, honestly, you're coaching the game between me and you. I mean, it wasn't anything crazy, you know, but like you're in the game. You're a player, like you've coached to, you know, it's like, you're just trying to get to the end. You know, you're trying to do your best for your team to get to the end.
Run that clock. Run that clock.
Hurry up.
Run the clock.
You're a nervous wreck. Yeah, you're a nervous wreck. You're nervous that, you know, the fouls are going to start, because at the end of games like that, they start driving to the basket over and over again. I was worried we were going to stop the clock every time, you know, with fouls, and they were going to shoot. It was going to be a parade to the free throw line. And so, you know, I learned long ago, Dad used to always start looking at the – when he had leads, he'd start looking at the – all right, well, what do I need to get to? All right, that they can't get to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
From a number standpoint. And so that was why I just encouraged them to keep trying to score if it's there, you know, take it when it's there. Because we were clearly shooting it well, so there was no reason to not do that. But, you know, it all hit me as soon as we let the clock go. Shot clock go, we had the shot clock violation, and it was just like a wave of emotions. It was kind of like, wow, this thing really happened. Holy cow. What now?
How'd you even play the next game?
I mean, you know, I wrote on the board at the end of that game. I went in there, wrote 0 and 135, right? And I X'd out the 0 and I wrote 1. And I said, you guys are the 1. And then below that, I wrote 0 and 0. And I said, wouldn't it be a shame, all right, if we were still thinking about being the 1 up here in this 1 and 135, and we didn't take advantage of the 0 and 0, the first 16's opportunity. All right, there's a responsibility that goes with that. And so let's all focus for the next 2 days and do our best, you know, to play our best, you know, give our best from a preparation standpoint. Do our best with the distractions while still having fun with it and go for it. And the guys did that. You know, we were in the game. We couldn't score a basket, but neither could Kansas State. And so it was a knockdown drag out to the end. I think we had 18 chances, you know, to take the lead in that game, and we weren't able to do it. But one of the coolest moments for me was before the game ever started. You know, I'm in the locker room, and you know how it is. You talk to your team, and then they go out. And I was in the locker room by myself, and you know, it was probably a minute and a half after they left, where I could hear the entire arena go berserk. And I knew exactly what it was. This group of guys that nobody cared about, they were going bananas for them. And so that made me happy, without a doubt.
Okay, so now we're a couple years removed, and now you were the 1 seed, you were the big dog, and you got upset.
Yeah.
And the problem with UMBC is you're not going to get a chance to go back to the tournament, because that's just not the way the conference is viewed.
Yeah.
In the couple of days since you lost, has there been a moment of, I should have taken one of those big jobs?
No, not at all. Because I love this, you know, I love this place, you know, I love everything about it, you know, but I understand what it is. I understand how hard it is, you know, at this level. But you know, this team, I told my team after we lost the other day, no one can ever take away. You won a regular season championship. That's not easy to do. Like, that hadn't been done here since 2008. Even the team that went on to beat Virginia didn't do that. And so they have a lot to be proud of, especially in a year where there were so many other obstacles outside of basketball that they had to navigate just to be able to have a chance at. And so, no, I'm thankful for the opportunity to coach at UMBC. I love the school. I love the people here. You know, I understand, you know, what it is. You have to win in March, you know, and that's what you sign up for. And the pressures of that, you know, it's so rewarding, but it can be heartbreaking at the same time, like what we're experiencing right now. It's like you're numb for 2 days. You know, you don't even want to watch another game because you put so much into it. But, you know, it is what it is. That's why March Madness is March Madness.
Last thing.
Yeah.
Will you secretly cheer against 16 seeds? No. So that you're the only one.
My wife definitely will. But no, I don't. If Virginia's a one seed again, I know they won't be this year, but they were the other year. I'm definitely not cheering against them. I don't want them to have that experience again. They don't. Once is plenty.
What was that experience like to watch them win the national championship just a year after you guys did what you did?
No, it was tremendous. I mean, it was extremely exciting for me because, you know, we were a part of their story, you know, and, you know, it's really neat. We had our own story, but they, you know, we were part of theirs as well, which were the two schools, the place where I grew up. You know, I'm forever connected to that, you know, which is pretty neat. And I know it wasn't a good memory, but it turned out to be a good memory for Virginia basketball and Virginia fans because it led them to a national championship, which is, you know, what it's all about.
I can't tell you how appreciative I am of your time, putting up with some technical difficulties. I know you got to go. Yeah. Let's catch up in person very, very soon. But thanks so much for taking the time.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for having me. My best to your family.
Same to you. Well, I knew you would appreciate it. It was long, it was thoughtful, and I would hope you would, one, download the podcast, download, subscribe, rate us, write a review. Doesn't have to be about me. You can hate me. I mean, I don't hate you. Write a review, and I think that helps us in some way or some form. But more than anything, pass it on to a friend. Like, there's some great tidbits about coaching. There's some great tidbits about life. And I think the passion that Ryan lives with, the realness with how he coaches kids and how he's handled success and failure, is nothing short of remarkable. And I'm so glad he got a chance to tell that story at this time. Anybody can, it's like after a win, anybody can tell a story after a win. Man, you can't shut me up after a win. What do you do after a loss? There's more great ones to come. So glad you downloaded and hope you subscribe, review, rate, listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show daily. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.